Thank you. Well, good evening, friends. Some of you had a break from me for teaching this Tuesday, but now you have me again here this evening, and on a challenging topic, our transgender moment as we consider transgenderism. I assure you I didn't choose this topic. The elders asked me to speak on this. This is about the sixth time I've spoken on this topic in various settings, either teaching in the marriage and family class at the seminary or conferences. And I don't enjoy this topic. I mean, I'm thankful to be invited. I'm thankful to speak. Please don't mishear that as unthankfulness or ingratitude. It's a lamentable topic. It's not something that we take up like excitedly, that this is something that we're facing at present. So we take it up with lamentation. But it's good to discuss how we respond. What are we to know? How are we to think in this present climate? And then how is the church to minister and care in light of this present climate? Also, just as far as a preliminary comment, I know this topic is fraught with pitfalls and difficulty, and I am going to seek to be as chaste as I possibly can be about this topic. That's a very like unchaste topic, just kind of by its own nature, right? But as far as the different age groups that we have before us this evening and the next two evenings, Lord's Day evening, I will seek to be as chaste as I possibly can be. Just to know where we are tonight and where we're going, tonight we're just going to talk about the lay of the land. Where do we find ourselves? And there's benefit in just understanding what the current lay of the land is, but it's kind of going to be the bad news tonight. Like, there's not going to be much, like, yay, like hope. And like, I mean, I hope we leave with some hope, and I hope we leave with that gives us some orientation, right, of where to go and how to minister. Next week, we'll be talking about the biblical response or the appropriate like a pushback with regard to the truth. And then the final time, we will be talking about and how does the church minister in light of this. So that's where we're going today, next week, and then the week after. Tonight, as we're getting a lay of the land, I hope we leave understanding that there are three primary groups when we're talking about the transgender moment of our culture. And these three different groups we would speak to very differently. And we have to understand these three groups so that we understand the appropriate biblical response. The first group would be those who actually are struggling with gender dysphoria, a very rare but real experience. We'll talk about that. And how to minister to folks in that situation is getting them the counseling help that they need and getting them the care that they need. The second group would be the activists or the ideologues, those who are pushing the ideology of transgender, again, the current transgender moment. And that group needs to be responded to with a stance on the truth. Like, we can't compromise on the truth. We need to stand on biblical truth and do so clearly. And then the third group would be those who are having this ideology inflicted upon them. Those who are suffering from this current landscape and this current ideology. So how we respond to those sufferers would be protection and rescue from such ideology. So three different groups and three very different responses depending upon the group. One of the things, I should begin by sharing an anecdote. If you're thinking like, what does this have to do with us? Will we ever face this in the RPCNA or in Hope Community? And you know, the things that I share tonight, I am in no way seeking to raise fear or raise concern. Like, that's not the point at all. It's just to raise awareness, right? So this summer, I had a phone call at the Biblical Counseling Institute from one of our Reformed Presbyterian pastors. Help, Keith, we have a family in our church professing, you know, family members in good standing. Their teen daughter has fallen under the influence of social media and this ideology and desires to transition. How do we minister to the parents? How do we minister to the teen daughter? So again, that's not to be like fear-mongering or this is coming to a church near you. It's to say this is real and this is facing even the RPCNA. and we should be aware, and we should know the appropriate pastoral biblical response. So the church needs to be ready. One of the things that I do with all of my classes, and some of my students love this and some of my students hate this, I share books that would be good for y'all to read if you want to read in this area, and it's also citing my sources as we begin. And so some of you who are like, no, I don't really care about reading these books, you can just check out. And for those of you who, you know, are interested, here, just four books as we begin, and again, citing my sources as well. Abigail Schreier has recently written the book Irreversible Damage, The Transgender Craze Seducing Our Daughters. And Abigail Schreier, she's not a Christian. She's not writing from a Christian worldview. She's a cultural reporter. She's just an honest reporter of just saying, this is the current milieu of the culture, and I think she has the pulse of our culture. And so she's just an honest reporter. And she's saying, this is what is taking place. I'm going to summarize her main argument even here tonight for us. The second book that I would strongly recommend, it's an outstanding book I think everybody should read. It's coming from a Reformed perspective, a Christian perspective. Nancy Piercy. Nancy Piercy is one of those people. She is a far better writer than she is a speaker. That's rare. But if you have the chance to listen to her summary of her book, don't. Read the book. The book is better. It really is. Nancy Piercy is an outstanding author. And what she does is she traces a personhood theory that there's a divide between our mind and our body, and who we really are is what we think. That's the real us, is what we think, our mind. And she traces that throughout all the hot-button issues of our day and age, you know, abortion, transgenderism, homosexuality, and so forth, and shows how this is really affecting us presently. It's personhood theory that is really what we're facing in our day and age. I'll summarize her main argument briefly here tonight as well. Another book, Ryan Anderson, When Harry Became Sally, Responding to the Transgender Moment. You see that I've borrowed his subtitle for our title these next 3 weeks, because I do buy Ryan Anderson's argument that this is just a moment. This is not the stop where our culture is coming to rest and really staking its ground on this transgender issue. It's just one stop of many on a bullet train. Well, it's going somewhere, and I'll present where I think it's going in the third time that we have together, the third evening that we have together. But Ryan Anderson's book, he's a Roman Catholic, and he's presenting things from a conservative Roman Catholic perspective. So again, you know, reader, be cautious, but just like Abigail Schreier's book, you know, reader, be aware kind of thing. This was the first book that was banned by Amazon. And so now he's, you know, marketing it that way. Read the first book that Amazon didn't want you to read that, you know, was banned. So you can't buy it on Amazon, but I do think it's a good treatment of kind of natural law argumentation of, let's just like look at how transgender practice really harms people. And that's really his argument, is let's see the harm and the cost associated with it. I do think it's a helpful book and a helpful just explanation of the medical science, really. And then an evangelical perspective that really kind of gets the pastoral heartbeat in all of this, of how do we minister to people? How do we care for parents whose children might be wrestling with this? How do we care for children who might be wrestling with this? And I think that this is the like least good entry in these four books that I'm listing, but I still think it gets the pastoral heartbeat right. And so that's why I'm listing this book as well. So God and the Transgender Debate by Andrew Walker. And then of course the RPCNA has a position statement that we put out, that Crown and Covenant has put out on transgenderism as well, that I would commend to you. Okay. Well, as we're, you know, still beginning, we need to define our terms. And I'm going to define our terms differently than the world is going to define our terms, but we still need to talk about these terms. And so you might think, oh no, he's drinking the Kool-Aid because he's using the same terms as the culture. No, we need to define our terms to know what we're talking about. I'm not defining them in the same way as our culture, but I think that we need to talk about these things rightly. So gender, anytime I'm using the word gender, I'm talking about biological sex. male and female. In the beginning, he created them, male and female, creating both male and female in the image of God. That's very different than how the world is going to define gender. We're up to 107 different genders that the world would recognize as legitimate genders. But I mean, if it's a spectrum, right, it's 107 and counting, because you can put a dot on that spectrum anywhere you want and fabricate a new gender if you want to do that, right? And so I'm speaking of binary biological sex, male and female. We will talk about, okay, what do you do about the exception of those who are born basically with a physical handicap that they don't necessarily present correctly for their biological sex? What do we do with these exceptions? We'll talk about that, but we argue from the norm to the exceptions as opposed to from the exceptions to the norm, right? And the goal is always, how can we see most conformity to God's creational norms and creational realities? That's always going to be our aim and our goal. Next, gender expression, how one expresses their gender in the world. Now again, the world is going to define that in a particular way, and if you're presenting in a certain way, well, then you are probably transgender and you need to go through appropriate therapies to change one's gender. But as we think about biological sex, we're created male and female, we do express ourselves in this world as male and female. And the scriptures call us to express ourselves appropriately as male and female. And that's not like culturally restrained in the sense that there's a wide range of how males present themselves in this world that's fine, that is okay. And there's a wide range of the way that females present themselves in this world, and that's fine. It doesn't mean we all men have to enjoy hunting and blowing stuff up and, setting fire to things to really be like that. That's what masculinity is. And, women, they have to be like quiet and demure, and they have to really enjoy, holding babies and stuff. And that's the only expression of femininity or something like that. No, there's a wide range of how we express ourselves in this world, and yet regulated by the Word of God. And when I say that, I don't mean something like profound. I just mean like simply and plainly that as a biological male, the scriptures say when I'm interacting with another biological male, I'm to treat him as a brother in the Lord. Or if I'm interacting with an older biological male, I'm to treat him as a father in the Lord. Or if I'm interacting with a female who's not my wife, I'm to treat her as a sister in the Lord, and one older as a mother in the Lord. The scriptures regulate how we are to interact with one another in this world, of course, recognizing still that there's a range of personality. Nancy Piercy says this in her book, Love Thy Body. The entire range of human personality traits is open to both sexes, that it is okay to be different from the prevailing social norms. So we all don't have to be John Wayne males, and it's okay, if women are assertive and enjoy sports or something, right? Like, there's a wide range, and that is available to us. Gender identity, how one understands their gender. Now again, the world is going to use that differently than we're going to use that. And yet we are to understand our identity, again, as regulated by the Word of God, as God would have me understand myself as a son, as a child of God, and same with, sisters and so forth, right? That our gender identity is still regulated by the identity of God's Word. And so then transgender, again, just defining our terms. I'm not justifying this, right? Like, I'm just defining terms. So I'm not saying, like, this is good. I'm just saying, like, this is how I'm using the term. A person whose gender identity does not correspond to that person's biological sex. And so, again, the world is going to use that differently than we're going to use that. One more word that we have to define, and I already used it, but gender dysphoria. And that is an enduring discomfort or incompatibility with one's biology and gender identity. Now, the transgender movement has been around at most for about 20 years. Whereas an understanding of people who are uniquely uncomfortable in their bodies in this way that we're talking about, there's been observation of that for about 100 years, of just recognition of, okay, yeah, there's discomfort, that some people uniquely experience this. It's very rare. 0.01% of men and 0.005% of women. So like 1 in 10,000 men, 1 in 20,000 women who experience this. So likely, I'm not speaking like in a gloss way here, I'm speaking statistically, like likely we've not met somebody who experiences genuine gender dysphoria. That's very different than the sudden onset that we are seeing now in teen years. Gender dysphoria typically, again, like the observable experience, this very rare experience, normally shows up between the ages of 2 and 4. It is persistent. It is observed by parents. It is a significant discomfort with one's body and wrestling with it. Whereas now what we're seeing is a very rapid onset in teen years of self-diagnosis, and then gender-affirming care coming around that person and saying, what you really need, what you are, you're trans, and so what you really need is transition-type therapy. Very different than historically the understanding of gender dysphoria. Just real quick, there are other dysphorias that I think we're familiar with that maybe can help us understand, again, this very rare experience of genuine gender dysphoria. Have you heard of phantom leg syndrome? Have you heard of this? Where somebody has a limb removed and they experience a pain or a cramp or an itch in that limb that's now missing. And so their mind is telling them one thing, their body's like, no, no, you have no leg, you know. My paternal grandfather was a diabetic and he had both of his legs removed before he died. And growing up in the 80s was kind of a weird time when I would like sleep over my grandparents' house. I don't know why this was the case, but like my grandma would like vacate the bed and go to the guest room and I'd sleep with my grandfather because like apparently I'd be scared if I slept alone and like boys have to sleep in the same, it was weird. I mean, nothing like weird happened. It was just, you know, strange time, I guess. And so my grandma said, Keith, Pap-Pap might pound the bed at times in the middle of the night. Don't worry about that. He just has a cramp in his foot. And I'm like, Grandma, he doesn't have feet. And she's like, yeah, I know, right? So that's a dysphoric experience, right? Your body is telling you one thing, your mind is telling you another, but it's a sincerely uncomfortable experience. Like my grandfather was genuinely feeling like he had a cramp in his foot and couldn't do anything about it. Another one is anorexia. Anorexia is a dysphoric experience. Looking in the mirror and seeing the reality of I am thin, but thinking I am vastly overweight and I need to lose a lot more weight, right? It's a dysphoric experience. And there are more that we could mention, but I won't do that. But I did say that I would summarize Abigail Schreier's book for you, basically her basic argument. Again, she's just an honest reporter. Not a Christian worldview, so reader, take caution, of course. But basic presentation, she says, look, in 2007 in America, we had exactly one gender clinic, and now we have over 300. Something has dramatically changed, right? And it's not because now we have rapid, sudden change in like physical, biological health. She is advancing, this is an ideology. This is she uses the term social contagion, that this is being advanced socially, culturally, and that is what's giving rise to this rapid experience. She cites the fact that Planned Parenthood gives out testosterone on a first visit, gives testosterone to minors, and depending upon the state, even gives testosterone to minors without parental consent whatsoever. So such transition can take place without any parental oversight. Also, she points out the fact that we are now at a place where allegedly, in our day and age, the only way we're supposed to know whether or not somebody is male or female as if they supply their pronouns to us. I mean, that's rapid change culturally that we have found ourselves in, right? Okay, so then she's contrasting historic understanding and observation of gender dysphoria and this rapid onset that I was talking about. So again, gender dysphoria, severe discomfort with one's biological sex, a real phenomenon, but exceedingly rare and typically affecting men, overwhelmingly affecting men. Again, beginning in early childhood between 2 and 4, and the little boy insisting, no, mommy, I'm not a boy, I'm a girl. It's consistent, it's persistent, and the one experiencing this is insistent that this is the case. They describe the experience as though their body feels all wrong. Now, if left alone, the classic treatment of this, if left alone, the vast majority grow out of it at puberty. That's without any intervention at all. That's just aging, right? That this experience goes away without intervention in 70%, typically just by going through puberty. Now, if given help and counsel, those numbers actually increase as far as those who grow out of it. And then those who don't grow out of it would be those that we would historically have referred to as transvestites or transsexuals, those who just want to present differently. Again, I'm not like justifying that, I'm just like reporting, right? And historically, they've not been trying to present themselves as though they are a different gender. It's like quite obvious that they're male and they're seeking to present themselves as transsexual, right? But that's different than what we find today. What we are facing, especially among adolescent girls, is a self-diagnosis of gender dysphoria and then affirmative care coming around those adolescent girls and leading them down a particular path. Now, affirmative care is not, let's provide counsel to grapple with this uncomfortability that I'm experiencing. It's instead to affirm this alternative gender and to affirm transition. This comes by teachers, this comes by therapists, this comes by pediatricians, those who would view themselves as engaging in affirmative care. And so then the typical next step is that they would change their name, that they would change their pronouns, that they would undergo puberty blockers. And then nearly 100% of those who would undergo puberty blockers then receive the opposite hormones that they would naturally be experiencing in order to go through the alternative puberty, the alternate genders puberty. And the result is nearly 100% guaranteed sterilization that these adolescent girls, primarily adolescent girls, would experience sterilization. Now, the third group that I was mentioning before, of course, is the ideologues, the activists, those who are spreading this ideology. And we might ask, why would anyone want to press the pause button on healthy puberty? Why would anyone want to encourage transition when, again, the overwhelming majority of those who are genuinely experiencing this discomfort will outgrow it naturally? And if given counseling help, the vast majority, again, will outgrow it. Why would we want to push this along? And of course, there is an agenda. There's a desire for pushing in this certain direction. The argument goes, these kids can't wait. We must transition them because the suicide rate is so high in this group of people. And if you hear that argument, I hope you hear in that argument the save the children fallacy. We must save the children, and the only way to save the children is through transition. You see the same type of argument with the abortion argument all the time. You Christians, you don't actually, you know, care about children, or else you'd be focusing on adoption. You just want to make moms, you know, make the choice that you want them to make. If you really cared about the children, you'd be focusing on adoption, right? It's a save the children fallacy. When we can care about both things at the same time, like it's also possible for us to genuinely care about the discomfort people are experiencing and to help prevent suicide. Like, we can do both of those things at the same time. It's not as though they're mutually exclusive. But you can understand why it would be very alarming to parents. And the argument goes, rather have a son than a deceased daughter, right? Like, you hear the fear-mongering, you hear the pressure in that. Now, as far as Abigail Schreier's argument of where this social contagion is coming from, schools, that this is being taught all the way down at the kindergarten level in public schools, certain schools, social media, that there are celebrities who are, trumpeting this. It brings a sense of popularity and recognition. Also, there are social media ways that people are being instructed on how to obtain testosterone and so forth. Like, you're being taught online how to go about this. And then also the gender-affirming care, that there is an entire community that will come around the individual and move them along a certain path. Well, that's basically Abigail Schreier's argument. Just to kind of further this, what is being taught, perhaps you've seen the gender-bred person. This is old now. This is not the revised version. But this was being taught all the way down in kindergarten levels in public school. So here we have the identity of the person, what you believe to be true about yourself, your true identity, that's who you really are. Then you have gender expression. And notice there we see biological sex. It's binary. We got to get rid of male, female. So now what we have is we have the gender unicorn. Also, because the gender-bred person like looks like a man, you know, like a gingerbread man. Now we can't have that. We need to get rid of that. So instead, we have this asexual unicorn that is being taught again all the way down to the kindergarten level. This is part of the social contagion that Abigail Schreier is pointing to. Now, I also said that I would summarize briefly Nancy Piercy's book as Nancy Piercy explains this divide between the mind and the body and applies it to all of the different areas in our culture. She basically says in personhood theory that the mind is who we really are, what we think about ourselves. That's our true self, right? The body is just kind of a machine. Now we can do with it whatever we want. Now, Nancy Piercy's not advocating this, right? She's just saying this has permeated Western thinking. And so think about it. It's okay to terminate a human life in the womb because it's not a person yet. It hasn't reached mental maturity, and so it's not a person, and so we can terminate. Or I'll be chaste again, but in our hookup culture, it doesn't matter what we do with our bodies. What really matters is finding somebody that we can love and settle down with, and until then, we can use our bodies however we want. So she traces this thinking throughout our culture. And you see how it applies for transgenderism. Your body doesn't matter. Your creational biological sex isn't what is important. What really is important is what you believe about yourself. So let's conform our bodies to our thinking, not our thinking to our creational reality. She quotes a transgender advocate, activist, and psychologist, Dr. Randy Kaufman, who says this: I tell them that we can't change the mind, so we have to change the body. That's it in a nutshell. I would let them know that if someone identifies this way, it's pretty rare that they would change their mind. We have known that we can't socialize someone into and out of a gender. Friends, I don't know about you, but I change my mind an awful lot. I change my body not at all. I mean, like a haircut and clipping my fingernails, but that's not really changing my body, right? Like, I change my mind all the time. I want to change my mind all the time. I want it to be renewed after the truth of God. I want to be expanded in my thinking as I read other books, to be sharpened and to have my horizons expanded. I want my thinking to change all the time, for the good, of course, right? But I don't want to be conforming my body to my thinking. Instead, the opposite is what we want. We want to be conforming our thinking to creational reality, whereas transgender ideology flips that on its head. Now, again, my goal tonight is just to get the lay of the land. But as we're talking about this, friends, I hope you understand that if we hold to a biblical understanding of male-female, in the beginning he created them as male and female, we are now labeled, as far as defining our terms, we are now labeled as transphobic. Because this is how the world would define transphobia, an intolerance of gender diversity based on the idea that there are only two sexes, male and female, which you remain in from birth. So what used to be common sense, what used to be common knowledge, is no longer common and is now being labeled as bigotry and as phobic. But here's the main takeaway. Those very rare few who are genuinely experiencing a dysphoric experience as little kids, let's provide them the help and the care and the counseling care that they need, give time to allow them to grow and mature and develop through this experience. Those who are advancing an ideology, let's stand firm in the truth and not compromise on the truth. Here we must stand. And the ideology must be seen as sinister and as predatory and as destructive, and it must be decried as such. And then for the third group, those who are being preyed upon, especially teens, and most especially teen girls, a demographic that is growing through perhaps the most physically uncomfortable time of their lives, right? The teen years, and you just kind of feel awkward in your body and you don't know what other people think, and so you feel strange, right? This group is in the midst of, again, what observers are seeing as the worst mental health crisis on record since COVID, with the highest rates of anxiety, the highest rates of self-harm, and the highest rates of clinical depression that we have ever seen. Add on top of that, they're in a school environment, if they're in certain public schools, where they can achieve immediate popularity by declaring themselves as a trans identity. Add on top of that, further still, the social media influencers who are telling that, you know, at-risk population that all of their problems will go away if they can just get on testosterone. And that's a group that we need to shield and care for and love and pray for, right? And so as we think about these three groups, there are three dramatically different pastoral responses. It's unlikely that we'll have much interaction with those experiencing genuine gender dysphoria. Again, I'm not being flippant in that, I'm just statistically, it's unlikely, right? Maybe we do have interaction, and that's fine, of course. It's unlikely that we will reach the activists and ideologues if they're entrenched in their perspectives. But it is most likely that we'll come into contact with teens who feel awkward socially and are being told that they may have been identified as the wrong gender from birth. And so again, we must shield, care for, love, protect, pray for. And so we must have the appropriate pastoral response for each of these three groups. Now, that's the bad news. That's the lay of the land. That's where we are, right? This was just to kind of set the stage. Next week is, okay, biblically, how do we make sense of this, right? And then the third week is, okay, how does the church actually provide support and care? But even though we're kind of ending on kind of a down note, it's still helpful to know where we are. And again, it's provided the foundation as we move forward.